I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Coming up later in the hour, we talk with this year's Mercy Otis Warren Cape Cod Woman of the Year, Mary Lou Pettit, and visit Huey's submersible Alvin as it celebrates its 50th birthday. But first, the story of a hidden love affair. Extramarital duplicity has been around for as long as marriage, but how affairs have been kept secret has changed with the times. Today we hear the story of a love affair that took place in the 1800s but was concealed for over a century in secret code. Sarah Day, a former Library of Congress writer and editor, stumbled across the truth after reading through decades of correspondence between Edward Everett Hale, a well-known and married Unitarian minister, and Harriet Freeman, an unmarried woman 25 years his junior, with a passion for science, travel, and the outdoor life. Sarah Day has written a book about their relationship, Coded Letters, Concealed Love, The Larger Lives of Harriet Freeman and Edward Everett Hale, and she joins us in Woods Hole. Thanks for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
So the name Edward Everett Hale may not be familiar for some of our listeners, but he was well known in the Boston region during his lifetime. What makes Edward Hale's extramarital affair so surprising is that it doesn't mesh with his very public persona. So tell us about Hale.
Well, he was considered by many to be the most moral man in America. He was a very eloquent and frequent writer of rather moralizing tracts and sermons, perhaps a little less so. And, well, he was very much admired for the social reforms, for his writings, for his preaching, for his whole persona. He was an extraordinarily kind, tolerant, and amusing man, the kind of man that made friends very easily, and he had friends everywhere. So I think it would have been quite shocking if this had come out during his lifetime. And most of all, of course, he was a minister. Right. So the fact that he continued this relationship and continued to be a minister, even to the point of becoming chaplain to the United States Senate, is quite extraordinary.
It sure is. Now, you write that discovering Harriet Freeman was the real revelation of uncovering this secret relationship. So tell us a little bit more about her.
Well, Harriet Freeman was actually of Cape Cod descent. I've been saying Brewster, but I'm told it's Brewster. She was descended from a long line from the early 17th century of Freeman family in Brewster, ships captains and traders. But her grandfather moved when he was very young with his family to Roxbury on the outskirts of Boston and became a bigger trader, and particularly with the Caribbean. And Hattie was brought up in a very comfortably off, even wealthy family. Her father had been in partnership with Elisha Atkins, who became a big sugar plantation owner in Cuba. So there was a bountiful income from both her father and her uncle's side. She was determined to lead an independent life. It was very difficult for a long time because her mother was failing, probably had dementia. As the unmarried daughter, she was expected to take care of her. But she persisted and found a way of studying science at the higher level in Boston. Her father would not allow her to attend Vassar, so she joined all the women's groups that were supporting the study of science for women in Boston.
Yeah, she was an accomplished botanist, geologist, and she was also a founding corporation member of the Marine Biological Laboratory. She was a lobbyist and activist for conservation and preservation. She's a busy lady.
Very busy. Yeah. Yes, and she also never stopped helping Hale with his writings. So to a certain extent, she was a collaborator, but one who was never acknowledged by him, acknowledged privately to her. So at the Andover Harvard Theological Library at Harvard Divinity School is the Harriet Freeman collection, which only came to light as the result of my researching this book, of everything to do with Hale, including all the books that they worked on together that he gave to her and inscribed, more or less acknowledging that she was a co-author. But it would need a different kind of scholarship to establish that.
So there was a 25-year age difference between Edward and Hattie, as she was called.
Yes.
But he had known her since she was a child. Her family were parishioners in his church. So when did the affair begin, and what do you think attracted the two?
Well, he he was always attractive to intellectual women. He was, surprisingly, since he was anti-suffrage and didn't seem to be pro-higher education for women, university education for women, he was very attractive to intellectual women because he treated them as equals and encouraged them. And Hattie was one of those women whom he encouraged. He really probably suggested to her early on as a young woman that botany and geology, which were his passions, might be hers too. She ran with that idea. And in a few years later, he acknowledged that her knowledge was far greater than his. And from then on, she really brought science to him, which made an interesting mixture of, you know, his theology and her interest in Darwin's and others' theories of evolution. And that's a very interesting theme through the letters, how she keeps bringing these latest theories on evolution to him. And
so there certainly was a physical attraction between the two that endured for decades. But as you're saying, they also connected on so many other levels, and they were intellectual equals.
Yes.
It makes us curious about his wife. His wife was not his intellectual equal.
No, she was not. She came from a very well-known family. Emily Baldwin Perkins was a member of the Beecher family. Her aunt was Harriet Beecher Stowe. Other aunts were Catherine Beecher and the suffragist Isabella Beecher Hooker. Most notoriously, her uncle, her uncle was Henry Ward Beecher, Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was probably the most famous minister of his generation. But he had this affair with a parishioner, Elizabeth Tilton, which was kept under wraps for a while. He was a charismatic minister who very much was beloved by his parishioners. But eventually the cuckolded husband brought suit against him, and it was the trial, the scandalous trial of the 19th century in 1875. So I think with that having happened in the family, as Edward Everett Hale was falling in love with Harriet Freeman, obviously discretion was very important, deception. He had learnt this, what I call code in the title of the book, but was actually a shorthand. He taught her this shorthand to disguise the more intimate parts of their letters. And it wasn't until I found the key to the shorthand that I was able to find that this was indeed a full-blown love affair.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you would think he wouldn't even want to take the chance after what happened,
I know.
Right? But I, you know.
But they were incredibly drawn to each other. I mean, they first met when she was 16, when he called on her family for the first time. This was in the south end of Boston. His church was the South Congregational Church. They were new parishioners. Then she began working for him when she was about 23, working for the church as a volunteer. She rapidly became indispensable to him. She had extraordinary editorial skills, and she became his most favourite literary amanuensis, which is the 19th century word for secretary. So not only was she an assistant in the church on the charitable outreach side, but also spent a great deal of time with him working on his writings. And then, of course, they found out that they were soulmates, that they loved the outdoors, they loved nature and science, and so it happened.
So this was the time when she became the secretary where they're spending this. That's when their relationships really started to blossom?
Yes. And in fact, she joined a group that he took every summer to the White Mountains. And as I say in the book, they were sitting on an outside seat of the stagecoach for the last part of the journey and to Waterville Valley. And she held up an umbrella, whether against the sun or rain, she couldn't remember. And he put his hand on hers to steady her. And the electricity happened.
Sparks, yeah. So at the time, did anyone suspect there might be something more to their relationship?
Well, I think quite a lot of people suspected. It took a while before there began to be gossip in the parish, as he told Hattie. But the person who knew most about it was Judith Andrews, who was Hattie's direct boss in the church. She was in charge of the South Friendly Society, the outreach, charitable outreach side of the society. Hattie lost her mother in 1880 and then later her father a few years later. Judith Andrews became her surrogate mother and undoubtedly an enabler of this relationship. Mm-hmm. I have to conclude that she didn't have a great deal of respect for Mrs. Hale, otherwise I can't see why she would have been such an enabler of this. Right.
So how did you stumble across the letters between Hattie and Edward?
Well, I worked at the Library of Congress. The biggest project I worked on there was I was co-editor and contributor to American Women, a very ambitious resource guide to all the American women's history collections across the library. We assembled a large team internally and we had an outside team of scholars. And when I was editing at the end, I saw the description of these letters in the manuscript division. For the first time, 3,000 letters described as love letters between the Reverend Edward Everett Hale and Miss Harriet Freeman. And it gave me enough of a sense that she might have been a woman of, you know, substance that I became interested. I forgot about it, left, started on another writing project. And a friend, Ken Woodcock, was very excited in Washington because he had purchased the Edward Everett Hale Summer House, which was about to be demolished in Matunuck, Rhode Island. He gave this to a local historical society with an endowment, and it is now a house museum open in the summer. The historian leading the project, who I told about the letters, said, "Do you have any time to go and have a look at them?" Well, I spent a day or so, and then I saw the shorthand, and that really caught my interest.
But something's going on here.
Yes. Now, you know, I knew it was shorthand because I'd learnt Pittman's shorthand in the I'm living back in the 19th century, in the early 1960s. Nobody knows what shorthand is anymore. There's absolutely no use for it. So in a way, I was tailor-made for this project because I recognized it as shorthand.
Yeah, no, I know that you broke this code or, you know, figured out that it was shorthand and you end up finding out that these really are love letters. But who had the inkling these were love letters if they were coded? Because they were so these were love letters.
Well, I think that the archivist who wrote that chapter for the manuscript division, there's enough in the longhand to indicate that something more is going on. And then, you know, in the middle of a sentence, it would break into shorthand.
Ah, interesting.
So she just reached that conclusion. When the letters were first purchased by a male archivist in 1969 from a Freeman descendant, and the letters are both ways, by the way, mm-hmm. both sides, he evaded the issue of whether it was a love affair altogether. Hmm. I have to credit this woman archivist for recognizing that they were love letters.
So there were more of Edward's letters, though, than Hattie's. Because,
well, the first 5 years, yes.
Because she instructed him to burn her letters, and he did for a time.
He did for 5 years. And I think this was partly because her father was still alive. And her father had a way of opening her letters now and then. In fact, all the envelopes for his letters still exist. And they're very revealing because some of them have been, you know, passed on, sent on from address to address, following Hattie around on her travels. And there are sometimes notes on the envelope. So her father wrote on the back of one of them, "Opened by mistake and not read," with his initials. So I think they had reason to be concerned. And, you know, she was from a fairly well-known, prominent family. So obviously she had to be as careful and discreet as he did.
Yeah. So tell us about this code and how you broke it.
Well, recognizing it as a shorthand, that stopped me asking the reference librarians where I could get a code broken. And so, but I couldn't read it. It was counterintuitive. The symbols looked the same, but I could not read it. It's a phonetic shorthand. The symbols represent sounds in words. So I carried on reading the letters. And luckily for me, when he was teaching her the shorthand, he mentioned the name of the inventor, an Englishman called Thomas Towndrow. Pittman's was also invented by an Englishman, by the way, a few years later. So I checked the subject catalogue at the Library of Congress and I found Tandro's manual for the shorthand and taught myself the shorthand.
Wow. So that had to be really... So now you've got the shorthand, you've taught yourself, and now you can read what's in the letters.
Yes, yes. And as the historian on the Edward Everett Hale House project said to me, we can't really understand what these letters, signify unless we can read that code. So, you know, when I broke that code. And by that time, I was completely hooked because these two people were so extraordinary in their different fields and their sensitivity too, sensitivity towards each other's feelings. And always Hattie, who was very fond of the Hale family. Hale had 9 children and about 6 of them survived to adulthood. She always wanted him to talk about his family and not so much about Mrs. Hale. That was obviously a more awkward conversation, but she was always asking him about his children, many of whom were very talented in their own right.
We are talking with Sarah Day. Her book is Coded Letters, Concealed Love, The Larger Lives of Harriet Freeman and Edward Everett Hale. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Sarah Day. Her new book is Coded Letters, Concealed Love, The Larger Lives of Harriet Freeman and Edward Everett Hale. So the relationship between Hattie and Edward went on for decades, and some years they spent more time together than other years. They might be apart for long periods. This took a toll on Harriet, and at one point she sunk into a deep depression.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was actually largely that her income was drastically cut as the result of the panic of 1893, the very severe depression of 1893. Her father's business, Etna Mills, a textile mill, which now was under the management of her cousin, Edwin Atkins, and the Atkins sugar plantation in Cuba were both seriously affected by that downturn and also the insurrection in Cuba at that time. But on top of that, her bonds, which were held by a New York bank, the bank went bankrupt. And so until she could bring a successful lawsuit, those were left. Her income was cut from, and this is incredible, she had a very good income indeed. $8,000 a year is, I really should know the equivalent today, but it's a very decent. Her income went down to $3,000. She felt she had to give up her house in Boston. The cost of running it was too much. That was the devastating thing because that was the home from home that she'd made for Hale.
Yeah.
He even had a key to that house and, you know, he was made very comfortable in that house. And she felt that without that house, that was the end of the possibility of seeing each other.
Right. And of course, her lack of a professional life at one point, she writes, it makes me long to do some work in natural history.
Yes.
I should be so much happier if I had more work in my life, something I had to do and could do. I believe that for unmarried women who have to earn their living in some occupation with which congenial and where the pay is so sure that they have no anxiety, that they are far happier than those who are living as I am. I feel as if I were playing with life and I am not satisfied. I am always making plans for my future, but they do not grow definite.
Well, part of it was her total devotion to Hale. She was the other woman, and she had to be available when he was available. And she, more than that even, she wanted to be with him. Mm-hmm. So
he was
the relationship,
yeah.
In the relationship, in the way, was a break on this brilliant woman.
Right.
Which I discuss, you know, in the epilogue. Yeah, at the beginning of the relationship, he worried that he was holding her back. But at this point, he wasn't worried about that anymore. And I started feeling rather angry with him because, I think he was very concerned when she got so depressed that she might be blurting out what was causing her depression. In fact, he suggested that she go to Philadelphia to see Silas Weir Mitchell, who was the most famous neurologist to treating depression at that time. This is pre-Freud, of course. Well, I don't know if you want to hear the Charlotte Perkins Gilman story, but
yes,
there's
go ahead.
A precedent to this. Charlotte Perkins Gilman was the the intellectual feminist of the late 19th century, early 20th century. She suffered from bouts of depression probably through much of her life. She, as so many women of that time did, because intellectual women just did not have enough outlets. Many of them were prevented from going to college. They were expected to marry and to stay home, and that should be enough. Well, Silas Weir Mitchell was actually the worst person for either Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Hale's niece, or Hattie to see, because he was somewhat of a misogynist, as you can see in his writings. And his prescription was, first of all, a rest cure, where, you know, milk and bed rest and so on. But far worse than that for intellectual women, cessation of reading, writing and intellectual activity. And this was proved devastating to Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And she was told to go back to her husband and be a good mother and a good wife. Well, within a year or so, she escaped to California and so began her freer intellectual life. But she was much chastised for that at the time in the newspapers and so on. So why did Edward Everett Hale, who helped Charlotte Perkins Gilman get her famous story, The Yellow Wallpaper, which was actually an indictment of the treatment she'd had in Philadelphia by Silas Weir Mitchell, it's a famous story, then recommend that Harriet Freeman go and see Silas Weir Mitchell? This is very, very hard to comprehend.
Yeah. So as she was very supportive of all of his endeavors,
yes.
But it doesn't sound like he was so much supportive of all of hers. I guess some.
Well,
that
he didn't visit her the mm-hmm. whole time she was in the Philadelphia area for that treatment, which was actually not much more than 2 to 3 months. But he was in the area, Philadelphia area, twice, and came up with what sounded to me like lame excuses for not visiting her, which makes me think that he didn't want to be, you know, he worried that this story might be
something
out.
Might happen. Yeah. Now, neither Edward nor Hattie ever brings up the option of him divorcing his wife.
No.
It was, I guess, almost unthinkable since it would destroy his professional life.
Yes.
But in her depression, Hattie does come close to admitting that their relationship might be morally questionable.
Yes.
But Reverend Hale never does. In fact, he describes their relationship as God-given and God-blessed.
Yes. I searched hard through all 3,000 letters to find any acceptance of the fact that this was counter to everything that he was advocating. He even wrote a letter to his favorite secretary, Martha Adams, on the eve of her marriage, with counsels of perfection about marriage. Never have any secrets from your wife, from your husband, you know.
He certainly didn't practice what he preached, did he?
There were times when I was just breathless with amazement. The word hypocrisy comes to mind. And yet this man was, I thoroughly acknowledge that he was a great man. He achieved a great deal. But how many so-called great men have been found to have this flaw?
Oh, and that is so true.
Yeah.
Only nowadays it's harder to keep secret with all of
yes.
the tweeting and emails and things that
you... Even if you put your emails in box drop, it seems
right,
they can be discovered.
Right. In 1903, Edward Hale leaves Boston and moves to Washington, D.C. to become chaplain of the U.S. Senate, putting his career ahead of his relationship with Hattie. This was a real blow to Hattie, as it made it much harder for them to spend time together.
Yes, and I'd like to read the end of the chapter when she has felt she's recovered her spirits, she's recovered her income, she's recovered her house. By this time, Hale is very old. He's retired from the South Congregational Church, although he remains as emeritus. And she feels that thoroughly happy. She has a long and now regularized emotional relationship. She's very close to her late brother's children. And she can have all these scientific adventures. But at the end of that chapter that I call An Adventurous Life, I say it must have seemed to Hattie that this happy state of affairs would continue for as long as Edward lived. But the letter he passed on to her on July 27th, 1903, from Matunuck shortly before she and the Hales set off for their month in Intervale together. Mrs. Hale would go with him for the first 3 summers, heralded a devastating blow to the pattern of their long relationship. Edward's old friend, Senator George Hoare, a leading Unitarian, wrote urging him to accept nomination to become chaplain to the United States Senate. Edward reported that the Hale women were keen for him to accept. He did not tell Hattie that he'd already telegraphed his acceptance to Senator Hoare.
Poor Hattie.
Yeah. And those months, he would spend about 6 months in Washington, the winter months, which is when she saw most of him, previously saw most of him. And her letters start becoming angry and bitter.
Yeah. And Edward dies in 1909 after a frail health, and after his death, one of the first things she requested from his secretary was the return of her letters, which was wise because, unbeknownst to Hattie, Edward had taught the secret code to others.
To his last two secretaries, to Martha Adams, who seems to have been an admirable woman, thoroughly trustworthy, and then her successor, Abigail Clark, who had skills that Hattie didn't have. She could type, for instance, and his writings generally, not just his letters, were so full of Tanjo's shorthand that he felt he had to explain the symbols to his secretaries so that they could translate those pieces, obviously forgetting that to Hattie and to him it was supposed to be the language of love. And now it was, you know, his two secretaries knew it. Abby Clark became and went with the family down to Washington and continued as his secretary down there, and Hattie became very jealous of her. She won the loyalty of Mrs. Hale and his daughter Ellen Day Hale. And, well, Hattie had been the other woman, so she knew what might be happening, even though he was in his 80s by that stage. But his charm never ended. Right. I mean, he was charismatic. He was charming. He was. So she worried that he might be getting too close to Abby Clark at the end.
Did Mrs. Hale ever suspect?
At this stage, I think Mrs. Hale had dementia. I can only guess at that. He was actually very good about not running his wife down in the letters. They both wanted to treat her with respect, but she seems to have been in another dimension in a way. She preferred non-intellectual friends, I think, and the conversation at table sometimes drove him absolutely mad, you know. Right. Hat decorations and
fashion. Yeah,
fashion. Right. And so.
Now, Hattie chose not to destroy the letters that she sent to Edward. What are your thoughts as to why?
Oh, well, I think that they sustained her to the very end of her life. She used to, I mean, there are notes on the envelopes, very interesting letter, San Francisco Fire. I mean, this is what absolutely held me. These two were so involved in all the major things of that period, and they would write their experiences backwards and forwards. So it's so much more than love letters. You know, some of these are 10 pages long, even longer, and full of interesting historical information. So I think as long as she lived, she wanted them. She wanted to be able, she kept them in a white trunk, and she wanted to be able to look at them again and again and recall their long relationship. But then when she died, she didn't destroy them. They went to her niece, Ellen Hale Freeman. And when she died, she had no immediate family, and a great nephew and his wife found the letters in the house in West Newton, and found the trunk of letters.
What a discovery.
I know. And I think the wife decided that these might be of historical interest. And so they were offered to Harvard, and they didn't accept them. And then they were offered to the Library of Congress. And thank goodness my dear friend, the archivist there, accepted them.
Yeah. This is a good lesson for people when you find some of these things like this that you think might be of no value.
Yes.
Don't throw them out.
Yes. Well, she was probably intrigued by the shorthand I was.
So what does Hattie do after Edward's death?
Well, she actually, in her frustration about the fact that she was seeing so little of him, and his letters were less and less responding to her concerns and her interests and so on. He was very old and he was frail and you know, sort of understandable. But she decided just a short time before he died that she and Emma Cummings, who had become her, you know, favourite travel companion, would go to Europe for 6 or 7 months. So she had already made those plans, and she only saw him once before he died. Mm. But it was a marvellous trip. So although her letters are very sad when the news comes through that he's died, she's immediately talking to her nieces about all the fabulous things she's seeing. And this begins a new era for her of world travels with Emma Cummings.
So what do you think the response would have been had their affair been discovered at the time? It would have ruined him, right?
I think it would have ruined him. Although looking back to Henry Ward Beecher, you'd say that that was far worse. I mean, this became a big, highly publicised civil trial. The letters between him and Elizabeth Tilton was handed over to a newspaper by the cuckolded husband, and it resulted in a huge literature, much of it pornographic. And but Beecher survived because his wife stood by him, and because Elizabeth Tilton, his former lover, kept changing her story. So I think it was reflective of the, you know, limited power of women at that stage. But Isabella Beecher Hooker came out, his sister came out and indicted him totally. The wife never forgave him. I think that Edward Everett Hale's affair had been conducted so much more discreetly. Beecher was really quite amazing in his the risk taking. Although I know people knew, I think he would have been forgiven. Beecher was redeemed. He continued. Right. He continued.
I love this in the epilogue you write on the Freeman side. Hattie's great niece Harriet McKiscock, whose mother, Helen Hunt Arnold, was persuaded by Nancy Hale to donate a number of Hale Freeman letters containing shorthand to Smith College, wondered in her 1997 notes on the collection. Question, was Aunt Harriet more than an intellectual companion? So there were suspicions, as you say. So it's so great that you cracked the code that we can be able to tell this story. And also to know a little bit more about Harriet Freeman, who people really didn't know much. She wasn't given the credit that she deserved.
And I don't think I've said enough about her. I mean, this woman was, as her obituary said, she led an extraordinarily active life. She was active in philanthropy. She was secretary of the Women's National Indian Association for years, 20 years or more, and other philanthropic organizations. She paid, she was on the corporation board of the Perkins School for the Blind, and she paid for Annie Sullivan to travel down to Alabama to teach little Helen Keller. Her companion at that time, Mary Cobb, who was another Brewster family, found accommodation for Annie Sullivan and little Helen Keller in the Elijah Cobb House in Brewster.
Yeah, you have a lovely photo in the book of that.
Yes, I mean, that photo was discovered in a collection that was left to the New England Historic Genealogical Society just a few years ago. And in this book, I'm able to say quite a lot more about the background to that photo and where it was taken. But there are all kinds of stories, and the letters are so rich. I had to cut so much. That was the agonizing thing. We were driving through Fall River yesterday, and I suddenly remembered that Hale attended the last day of Lizzie Borden's trial, the axe murderer.
Right, right.
And, of course, she was acquitted that very day. And he wrote to Hattie, "I'm sure she's guilty." And he gave quite a complete description. But I couldn't find how to fit that into my narrative. And the letters are so rich in that way. And in a way, I'm hoping that I am alerting the wider scholarly community to these letters, which were completely forgotten.
Yeah. The book is Coded Letters, Concealed Love, The Larger Lives of Harriet Freeman and Edward Everett Hale. Sarah Day, thanks so much for cracking the code and sharing it with the rest of the world. We appreciate your time.
And thank you for giving me the time.
Coming up, we talk with this year's Mercy Otis Warren Cape Cod Woman of the Year, Mary Lou Pettit, and visit Hui's submersible Alvin as it celebrates its 50th birthday.
For the past 13 years, the Cape Cod Woman of the Year Committee has awarded the Mercy Otis Warren Award to a Cape Cod woman who's demonstrated leadership, community involvement, and has made significant contributions to the arts and education. This year's recipient is Mary Lou Pettit, and she joins us on the phone from her home in Eastham. Good morning and congratulations on the award.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now, you've been a community leader your entire life. County Commissioner Sheila Lyons wrote in her nomination of you, quote, "Some of us see poverty. Mary Lou sees injustice and says, let's fix this. And she has and still does." So what do you attribute your commitment and drive to help others?
Well, I'm going to be rather trite, I suppose, with my answers and say the usual, the F's, family, faith, and friends. I really do feel that that combination prompted my interest and passion, really, for human rights and civil rights and incorporating that into the democratic version of our country and making sure that that was available to everybody.
Homelessness and community development have been two of the many areas that you've concentrated your efforts, although you've been active on many other issues, too. Can you describe how the Cape community response to issues of homelessness and community development has changed since you first arrived in the mid-1980s?
Well, the whole idea of working in the area of housing and homeless, I think, was prompted by the March on Washington, which I participated in 1963. And the message I took back from Dr. King was, do what you can where you live. And I happen to live in a rather affluent suburb of New Jersey, and the thing I could do there was to try to take the issue of housing, which evolved certainly into homelessness down the line, and make it accessible to all people, not just certain people that were could get accessed at that time. And so that did start, I guess, the lifelong interest in housing and the fact that I could respond to that where I lived. My neighbors could be of all races, of all income levels, if I worked for it. I must say I'm still working on that. It hasn't happened to the degree that I wanted it to.
Yeah. And when you got here in the 1980s, how did you come to Cape Cod to begin with? You said you grew up in New Jersey, so how did you make it to Eastham?
Well, my husband, who worked in New York City for Pfizer, took early retirement, and we had vacations. This is everybody's story, I think, on Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. We had vacationed here for many years with our family and loved it and had built a house here to decide whether we wanted to live here year-round. And we had always vacationed in Eastham in the Lower Cape area and loved that, the feel of that. And so we did decide to move here, thinking that, oh, our children will visit because they love Cape, and so we'll get to see them. Well, we didn't know that all three of them were going to move here, too. So that happened. But and then there was a job when we got here. I had been working in New Jersey for the state of New Jersey on housing issues, and I was going to take my break for about a year. And when we got down here at the local newspaper, there was an ad for a coalition coordinator for the Lower Cape. And I looked at it, and I thought, well, that's what I've been doing all this time in New Jersey. And so my husband said, why don't you go and apply for it? And I said, well, they'll want somebody who lives here. But at least I'll get to know people. I'll meet people. And I was hired for the job. So that started it right away.
Yeah. And you got right to work, too. You've been very active. You've been described as a role model for women who successfully balance family, work, community leadership, both as a volunteer and in your career. So what's your secret to balancing all of that?
I don't know. I think there are quite a few models for people today, particularly strong women. It was much more difficult for Mercy to be speaking out when she did than it is for some of us to be speaking out today. But I just felt that my mother was a strong person and worked at a time when women weren't working. I guess it's the Irish genes in me. I just feel that it's important to do what you can when you can and do it in any way you can. I noticed in reading more about Mercy Otis Warren that she was very impatient with people's progress and with the progress toward the Revolutionary War. She thought they were too cautious. Well, we do share that in common. I can get a bit impatient with the cautious pace that we're taking today, and then the having to re-win battles that you thought you already won. I'll point out the Voting Rights Act. That's what we thought the March on Washington was all about, was moving us toward better voting procedures, open voting procedures, and now we're fighting that all over again. So I do get impatient sometime at the cautious pace we move, and if I'm a model, I don't want to be a model for impatience, but at least for a faster movement to realize the values of our democracy.
And Mercy Otis Warren, for people who don't know, was a Cape Cod native born in 1728. She became a community leader and pioneer in women's causes, a champion of liberty, an advocate of the Bill of Rights, all during a time when women weren't supposed to be doing those things. And in addition to being community leaders and having impatience, were there other similarities between you? Did you have other things in common?
I see my degree of impatience around the leadership in both parties, and Congress certainly is an example of today, I think, and I think Mercy might be a bit upset with that also, the slow pace and not tying up the really work of democracy the way they're doing. And I see that also sometimes at our own county level, that we can't seem to work together in the positive way to move forward on issues, and it's evident that we can't do as much as we should to keep that democratic spirit that Mercy Otis Warren was so active in. Keep it alive and keep it going. We get tied up in personalities and issues that have nothing to do with what needs to be done.
Yeah. It seems so much harder.
That
does. And it seems, as you're saying, it seems so hard to get things done no matter what it is you're trying to do. You talk about personalities sometimes getting in the way of progress. Do you think it's harder for us now to find some common ground when we're approaching an issue?
You mean common ground in order to get things moving forward?
Yeah.
You know, I think we can. That's a good question because I've thought about it myself. How do we come together now when it's so difficult to even talk to each other? And I think we have to go, this sounds corny maybe, but we have to go back to how we all started. And certainly we ought to be able to do that on Cape Cod, where the Revolutionary War and Mercy were such a part of life here in this area. And we grew up on it. I'm from the Midwest. It's so much closer here than beginnings. And we ought to take more pride in that and say, let's come together for the good of the country instead of trying to make ourselves the center of attention. And I think that's what everybody's trying to do. They attack each other instead of thinking about, and I think it's going to be a struggle. We certainly have to be more civil to each other to begin with, and maybe Mercy's name, Mercy, is a start. If we thought of a little more mercy, we might approach it, but I think it's going to be difficult.
All right. Well, the Mercy Otis Warren Cape Cod Woman of the Year Award will be presented to Mary Lou Pettit as part of the program Tales of Cape Cod at 7 p.m. June 9th at the Old Colonial Courthouse in Barnstable Village. In addition, Mary Lou will be an honoree at the 4th of July Parade in Barnstable. Thank you for taking time to join us, Mary Lou, and congratulations on the award.
Well, thank you. I feel very honored.
Today marks 50 years since Alvin was first christened on the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution's dock. HUI has planned a year-long celebration, which includes a special Facebook page and website for people to send their birthday messages. In May of 2013, Alvin, the U.S. science community's only human-occupied submersible dedicated to deep-sea research, underwent a thorough overhaul and upgrade. The iconic sub was redesigned and rebuilt piece by piece by a one-of-a-kind team of engineers, technicians, and pilots at HUI. WCAI's Jenny Junker and Samantha Brown of Atlantic Public Media paid a visit to see how the work was going on the project. They didn't say no to a chance to get inside the sub's personal sphere.
Okay, my name is Brian Durante, and we are inside of Alvin, DSV-2 Alvin, the brand new sphere. that was built to go 6,500 meters versus 4,500 meters. And you're very lucky because not a lot of people get to come in here. This is the pilot's console. You look down at that in drive versus looking out the window. You can look out the window. The joysticks, it's like a big video game. That's an observer seat, and this is an observer seat, and they're actually benches, and they don't look it right now, but they're really comfortable, which they need to be because you're usually gone for 8-9 hours at a time. So,
where's the bathroom?
Usually they keep those bags under the floor, so you try to hold it.
My name is Bruce Strickrott. I'm Alvin's expedition leader. I'm one of the senior pilots. I've been here 17 and a half years. This is our toy. Think about it. If you're a grown man and you went back and found your 10-year-old self and said, this is what you're going to be doing for a living, wouldn't you be stoked? I would be.
Absolutely.
Look at it. It's not, and it's a very complex machine, right? But it's also a blast. Not going to lie. I'm going to be up here working. I can tell you, we had an exciting day Saturday. We put 500 pounds of liquid mercury in the submarine, liquid metal. So we suited up. We closed the whole space. We put on the environmental suits and masks and all that. And we poured it into these two spheres over here. Real slow. It's real methodical. We don't spill any.
This is amazing.
Yeah, it's quite a piece of technology that they designed here. It's a real expensive ball of titanium.
And they bring food?
They eat like the space people, like astronauts. It's, everything is, you know, compressed and freeze-dried and stuff like that. That's the emergency stuff. I guess you bring a lunch, so.
Bring a lunch.
As long as it's not greasy, because of the it's a 100% oxygen atmosphere.
How about music? Can you listen to some tunes?
Yes, there is. I haven't put the speakers in yet. There'll be a whole music catalog that you can pick from. And Brian's List, If I Go, Jefferson's List, Chris's List.
You gotta please the pilot.
Yeah, well, you're driving, so.
When things happen, you'll see things out the window that are there for like 2 seconds, and you'll be like, holy cow, that's different, and then it'll be gone, and you'll never see it again.
Now, the chances of the sphere imploding or the windows are, I mean, I'd feel comfortable bringing my daughter down in it, so. It's built very well. There's plenty of people that have worked on it in years past that don't want to go down in it. It's very claustrophobic, and you gotta realize that there's no fast exit. So this is an emergency dump panel, and what this does is if something happens and you get stuck on the bottom, the sub is built to float. If you take enough stuff off it, these will dump all the thrusters off. You can drop your batteries, rescue buoy, your manipulator arms, and they'll just fall off the sub and make the sub lighter, and eventually will float to the top, you hope. And if something were to happen to the sub, there's enough oxygen on board for 3 people for 72 hours. So you could stay on the bottom for 3 days and before you would start running out of oxygen.
Wow.
Yeah. If you were down at 4,500 meters and you were to experience a hole, say, in the hull, and you wouldn't even know it. You'd hear a slight noise and then it would just be over. You wouldn't even, you'd feel no pain. You'd just be crushed instantly.
We got the move at, say, 3:30 to 5.
Is this what you always wanted to do?
No, actually. I wanted to be a rock and roll drummer.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade.
Sound recording by Samantha Brown, audio postcard production by Jenny Junker. Links to the HUI website and Facebook page for birthday messages for Alvin can be found on our website, capeandislands.org. You can also find video footage of Alvin arriving on Water Street back in 1964. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.